the Eternity Podcast Network, eternitypodcasts.com.au.
Hello, I'm Jenny Salt, and welcome to Salt, a place where we'll enter into the lives of people and discover heartwarming, sometimes challenging, yet always distinctive gospel stories.
He was completely unruffled by what I thought was a pretty powerful intellectual assault on his belief system, but he seemed to have answers. It was the first time in my adult life I'd confronted another adult that was prepared to do battle and do it well.
My guest today is Tim Sims. Tim grew up in more countries than most people visit in a lifetime. An Oxford and Harvard graduate, he went on to establish what became the world's most successful small consultancy. But a life in business took him to the bottom of himself before God raised him to new heights. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks very much, Jenny. It's great to be here.
Tim, as we listen to you speak, we will hear an accent, which tells us that you're from not these parts in recent years, or at least you've been here for a while, but you come from another part of the world. Where do you come from?
Well, Jenny, that's a nice question, because when I go to my place where one of my parents was born, they accuse me of being Australian.
Oh, do they? They accuse you of being Australian.
Yeah,
they don't compliment you on being Australian.
Fair enough. But actually, the truth is quite complicated. So if you'll bear with me for just a minute. My father was born in Hong Kong of English parents, and my mother was an orphan born in New Zealand. And he, I think, fled from a rigorous educational establishment type environment to work on a sheep station there, joined the New Zealand Defence Force, and was trooping the colour one day and was spotted by an orphan in the crowd. And that was the beginning of, I suppose, my life.
That's right.
So they worked in international aid. So he was working for UNDP for most of my childhood in many different countries.
UNDP?
United Nations Development Project. So this was an effort on the international community's behalf to take good work into communities. They weren't Christians, but he was a man of great sense of duty and commitment to those that were impoverished and hurting. And so we ended up living in lots of interesting places, Uganda early on, Iran in the early 60s, mid-60s in Jordan, later on in India, and Botswana, then Portugal. And in all of those countries, in fact, we were there at times of great conflict and difficulty, because obviously in dry countries,
yes,
where you're offering aid, they're often unstable.
Of course.
I went to boarding school in England because there were no schools in those parts of the world that were going to take us beyond the very basic education. My mother was a school teacher, but she found it hard to combine the roles of teaching and being a mum for us. We're pretty wild, brother and I. So we ended up in a British boarding school at very young ages.
So you were at a boarding school, as well as going to the various countries that your parents were living and working in for the school breaks, is that right?
Yes, it was. There's a place in England called Bath in the west of England. On my grandmother's side, there had been engineers and soldiers, and those sort of people retired to Bath. So there was a sense that Bath was home, in that awful way that generation of English people referred to England as home, but they'd never really been there. So we ended up in a small boarding school there, and by the grace of God, it was a school for missionaries' kids. Which I think appealed because it was cheap and relatively inexpensive. But that was the first time I was exposed to Christian things. I'd come from Iran. I was on an airplane. We'd fly back for holidays. But I got there, and the first class, everybody stood up and said something very quickly that I later on identified as the Lord's Prayer. Never heard such a thing. That was my first exposure to Christian things.
Mm. So your parents didn't send you to that boarding school because it had a Christian influence. And yet there you were. How old were you when you first went to boarding school?
I'm almost afraid to tell you, because when I meet kids of that age now, I can't believe it could have been true. But I went when I was five, and I went because my brother was seven and he was ready for school, and it seemed good to have us both be together. So five's pretty young. And so you end up in a dormitory environment with lots of other boys at a very young age.
For those of us who haven't been to boarding school and perhaps have seen boarding school in movies, perhaps you can tell us what it was like for you and perhaps a memory or two of what it was like as a young boy being in a boarding school.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most distinctive moment or part of the day that's different from normal school is the nighttime. It's distinctive because there's no family in the formal sense there. You're in a room full of cast iron beds. In those days that had been borrowed from the military, I think, after the war, there might be 20 other boys sleeping in that room. Some of them are not coping well, because boarding school is a place where often children of divorced situations go, or there might just be people not coping well. So they'll, certainly in the early parts of a new semester, they'll be weeping and misery. And so that's confronting, moonlit rooms of sadness. But you're left to reflect on how to deal with that. And certainly early on for me, that became a sense of, I don't want to say robust, but certainly resilient decisiveness, that I was not going to be one of those that spent my time grieving. I was going to be one of those that made a joke, changed the atmosphere in the room, looked out for the little guy who was, say little guys, but they often were, we were all little, who was suffering or did those things. So I think it sorts you, don't you? Some are broken by it and some are quietly helped to form a view. And of course, the ones that write about it years afterwards are the ones that are broken and never recover. So I'm far from saying it's a bad system. I think it's a system that makes the most of 90% of those who go there. It turns out extraordinary resilience. And I think it probably damages badly another portion. I can think of people now who probably to this day have not fully recovered. No fault of the school, but they were people of increased sensitivity or different backgrounds that never could stabilize in that environment. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So you heard the Lord's Prayer for the first time.
Yeah.
As well as that, you were exposed to Christian teaching. Do you remember what else you learnt in those days as a young boy?
Well, we had... from a Christian perspective, we had chapel every day, and that was pretty interesting. I loved to sing. I loved anything that had to do with being around my mates and enjoying that. So that was always good. I think profound moments. I think I was very struck by the humility and the wisdom and the grace of some of the members of staff who were clearly absolutely committed and impressive, mature Christians. And in hindsight, I can say that made a big impression. They were different. And there were a couple of very particular moments. Strangely, it's now come back in history, but I was on a Salvation Army hall once on a cold winter's night in the mist. And a woman was talking to us whose name was Doreen Irvine. And Doreen was the mistress of the Warlock of England before she turned to Christ.
Goodness.
As a drug addict, she'd entered the back pews of a church one night in desperation in London and heard the word and been turned. And so she became a person who traveled the country to say it's real. There is Satan worship in the country. They are doing these things, which she described, in these places. And I have turned to Christ and I have a story to tell. And I remember being surprised by how moved I was to hear that witness, you know, as a sort of a little secular boy who's going to chapel and enjoying singing and noticing a few Christians around. That was probably the first time I really felt a sense of profound metaphysical presence and real questions crowding in. How could it be? what was this about? Because it was so alien to any world I'd been encouraged to believe in as a child.
Were they encouraging the boys in the school, including you, to consider what it means to be a Christian, or were they assuming that you were Christians?
They were. Every dormitory was named after a missionary. We're sitting in the premises here at SMBC. You'd be pleased about that.
Yes, very.
I, in fact, remember that I was in a dormitory called Hudson Taylor.
Oh, that's wonderful.
For the few minutes before lights out every night, you were supposed to read the Bible, Scripture Union notes I remember seeing around and things. But that was really for the goody-goodies. Anybody who was a real card-carrying rebel made sure that they weren't seen to be reading the Bible at that time.
And you were a card-carrying rebel at that point?
Well, I think I became one by default. I think I was that sad combination you often see of certain types of people. They're probably insecure, but they're fluent and, at least in their own minds, temporarily funny enough to raise a laugh with their mates. So I was that guy. And so I was a rule breaker in a nice way. I didn't do dastardly things, but if there was an opportunity to flaunt authority, I was the guy. And they had a very signal or obvious punishment system, which was often to take exercise in the early hours of the morning, running on old pack horse tracks on the hill nearby. And so I became that guy. So as the sun came up, I was Sims Minor, was running the hill.
Sims Minor.
As the sun went down, Sims Minor was running the hill, which was fantastic because actually subliminally made me a very fit guy. But also it was a strange way, I think, of flaunting the system and in a happy way, if I can say it that way, gaining attention.
So that was part of your identity as a young boy.
It's a rule-breaking guy, a good rule-breaking guy.
Yes, yes. So you continued on in boarding school, going to your parents wherever they were. Do you have any memories of particular places that you went to for your holidays?
Oh, so many crowd in and we could spend hours talking about them. But things that might be of interesting things to listen about for your listeners. It began in Iran. So I do remember, for example, going to Mashhad, which is a sacred city in Iran. The inner area of that is closed to non-Islamic people. And I had a very brave mother dressed in a chador, which was the traditional dress. And I won't describe where we went, but we certainly had a very close look at Mashhad, for example, or Jerusalem. When we were in Jordan, because we were there before the Seven Days War, a large part of Jerusalem was still in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And so literally you could drive from Amman, where we were living, to Jerusalem in a few hours. And we'd often go there for weekends and things. So Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran, you name it, all of those places were very familiar places in childhood.
I want to tell you about another podcast, which is a great listen. It's called Evangelism in a Skeptical World with Sam Chan. Now, if you know anything about Sam, he is a great evangelist. He's very well thought through and has some great advice on what it means to talk about the gospel in a modern context. To find out more about this and other great podcasts, go to eternitypodcasts.com. You didn't become a Christian in school. You went on to university and on still not really understanding the gospel. Is that right, Tim?
I think so. I respected Christian people to a point, although I could see another breed emerging in school, which were sort of people who sort of what we describe as goody-goodies, but people who sort of took it on and overplayed it as young people. But there were still those mature Christians in the background. So I was fortunate. It was a relatively modest school, but from time to time, some of us were fortunate enough to be put up for the Oxbridge exam to go to Oxford and Cambridge, which is a distinct and separate experience in the UK university system. So you stay an extra semester and you take a rather interesting exam which has no curriculum. And so you end up facing questions like, what is history? or is this a question? Which of course, given the character I've just described to you, rather suited my demeanor.
Yes.
It's perfect. So the examiners were fooled again, not for the first time and not for the last time in my career. So I went to Oxford.
What sort of student were you when you were at Oxford?
Well, I loved the topics that I was there to read, but I loved sport more. And so I spent a lot of time playing rugby and rowing. And the result of that was that I was probably more front than content when it came to the curriculum. But I had a plan. That little boy from the dormitory days had a plan. My plan was to 10 weeks before the beginning of the exams, and there are going to be 10 exams, which you sit in 5 days, so 6 hours of exams a day, when your whole fate will be decided. You have no mark until the last week, finals week.
That's pressure.
And it's a different story, which I'll tell you separately, but I hadn't attended very many lectures. And so we got to the end of that process, and I had the plan. The plan was to do that study, and it was a week per paper. Problem with the plan was that I'd only allowed 9 weeks for 10 weeks of study, and that didn't become apparent until we got very close. And then it was a question of, could you really study a topic and land it in 2 or 3 days, or did you need the week? And the answer is, you need a week. And so I did get to the point where I was in finals week and I had an exam I hadn't studied the curriculum for. I'd neither studied it very diligently while it was going on, nor had I studied it in preparation for the exam. You may not know that feeling, Jane, but it's a...
sounds very stressful to me, I have to say.
It's certainly concerning, and you begin to think about what letters you'll need to write to your father to explain that after 3 years in an esteemed location, you don't come home with an exam pass. But I had a plan, or a plan emerged. There was a man, a very diligent man of Catholic faith background, who'd slept on a stone floor with a wooden stool under his head and written his notes in secret, a cipher, because his thoughts were of such quality that nobody else should be able to read them. And I thought, if I tuck in alongside him, it's a 40-minute walk to the exam schools. I will ask him what's going to come up in the exam, because he'll know as much as any other living being. And I'll ask him to describe his essays to me. There'll be 4 to be written in 3 hours, and quote the quotations. Well, praise God, in retrospect, all 4 of those questions came up, and I was able to execute on the exam, and the rest is history.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate, but it's a good example of that kind of, so what do we do now? What do we do now? Because to panic in that situation would have not been helpful.
That's right.
But as I look back, you know, God's providence.
Yeah.
That was so unusual, so extraordinary. That's what happened.
Wow.
And really enjoyed that time. It was a time of great intellectual and personal growth.
Mm-hmm.
But again, had nothing to do with Christianity. And if anything, my relationship with Christianity was more one of taking an opportunity to mock and to, in a nice way, again, nothing really seriously nasty, but certainly unhelpful for Christians who would express unthought-through views. You've seen that behavior. So have many Christians.
Yes.
So I was that guy.
Yes.
Again, larrikin, tell me about your faith.
Yes.
What do you mean, really?
Yes.
Faith? What's faith?
Yeah.
Those sorts of pathetic questions. So that was me. Sally, my wife, was different. She had a sense of profound God presence and faith. She'd been from a Church of England family, and she'd been to a Catholic convent. So what she had was a sense of the presence of God and a great sense of sin and needing to be good. This will be interesting to those of your listeners that are sort of theologically aware. That combination leaves you with a sort of sense of duty and a sense of, how can I be good enough? So things went on.
You were married to Sally by the time you went to Oxford, is that right?
No. I stayed in touch with her. I was fortunate to go on with a scholarship to Harvard after Oxford, stayed in touch with her. And in fact, foreshortened my time at Harvard. It sounds self-promoting, but I managed to arrange it. an arrangement with the examiners that if I got marks that were sufficiently high, I could be regarded as a mid-career student, which was a little bit of a long bow because I was still not 21. But that was my method for getting back to London to see Sally.
Really, when you think about it, Oxford, Harvard, I mean, these are the preeminent schools, universities in the world. So you're really on quite a trajectory, humanly speaking, to being a very successful man. I'm looking forward to hearing how you became a Christian, but you went back to London, to England, and did you marry Sally at this point?
Yeah, so there was a strange, again, life, all of our lives are happenstances to the non-Christian and providential to those of us that believe in God. But there was a strange twist of fate again, in the midst of all of this, which is I needed to see the boat race in London, Oxford-Cambridge boat race. My great friend from the playgrounds of that school we spoke about was rowing for Oxford that year. And I was proud to be wearing a Harvard crew jacket. And so this moment in history was going to occur where I would arrive in London in my crimson jacket and he would be there in his blue jacket, and it would be amazing. But I couldn't afford to go. And so I looked around for people who would interview sight unseen people with resumes like mine. And I was clearly set to go and work for the World Bank and work for underprivileged and struggling communities as my father had. That was going to be a good plan for my life. But the consulting industry back then, they were willing to fly me to London. And so I ended up going there. I had a very fortunate interview. I didn't know anything about business, but the man who interviewed me asked me about particular aspects of deregulation in the US that I knew a lot about. And I was therefore once again thought to be capable in the interview process, and I got an offer. And then the other competitors fell in behind that. What I ended up doing, in fact, was I happened to be fluent enough in French and German. And the consulting firms were going to Europe at the time. And so it was a wonderful time for me to follow around very capable business analysts, translating for them to business leaders in Europe, seeing what was happening there. So purely circumstantial, but that's what happened next.
When you talk about consultancy firms, for those in the biz, they'll understand what you mean. But what does it mean to work for a consultancy firm?
Well, I mean, there are lots of different consultants, which is one of the reasons why consultants are wary about the label, and those that use it are often wary too. What we were doing in the end was we were working. So I started with a large US-based consulting firm, and then at the ripe old age of 25, having been around Europe and seen these different meetings that I described, I formed the view that what was really going on in those meetings was you had an insecure person leading a very complicated corporation who, yes, needed people with calculators and those things. That was necessary to deliver the project. But actually, they need a lot more than that. They needed fellow travelers on a hard journey to deliver high share price performance in a very competitive and very difficult environment. So the simple deduction from that was to produce a service that did just that. It was concerned about the leaders of those companies personally and helping them to succeed. And the measure of that was going to be extraordinary share price gain. And so we went to camp out in a shirt shop, over a shirt shop in German Street in London, which, if you know, London is where all the shirt shops are. In fact, I'm wearing a German Street shirt right now. And we started a company that focused on helping chief executives to do that. And it was extraordinarily successful for reasons that we didn't fully understand at the time, but had to do with the difference between conventional business and that promise. So those companies became the largest in their various sectors. And that's what brought me to Australia. I had to open the Asia Pacific operation. We became, in fact, the world's largest small consulting firm.
Wow. So your trajectory continues just to go up, up, up. How did you become a Christian given that trajectory? Because it sounds like you've got everything that you could possibly imagine that someone would want.
Well, you're right to place that challenge there, Jenny, because if you imagine, so I divorced myself from the idea of being that person and looking from the outside. What you had was kind of a, I suppose, an insecure person, but in, I keep saying in a nice way. I was, you know, I had good friends, but I was always seeking attention and playing around. And then one of those without faith in God, who was blessed by a great deal of worldly distraction, and didn't ever, I think, come to a place in me where I thought I was that act. I didn't think I was that person. So I was nursing a sense of self-awareness and, I think, inner gentleness and concern, which in the end, I think, was quite important. But what actually happened was we had our first child on the way, Anna. And I reflected on that. I studied a lot of philosophy and been involved in lots of debate and all the things that I've described. And I felt that I couldn't face that child without having a clear ability to say, I've thought about life and here's why we're here. Or I've thought about it and there is no answer. Or I've thought about it and here's a way you might begin to think about it. But not to do that felt almost impossibly irresponsible with that first child coming. So I began to read, and being arrogant, or at least having grown to be arrogant through that process of learning and exams and scholarships, I started with the wrong precept. I started with this idea that I would find the truth. It's a common thing. So by sheer force of investigation, I would find the truth. So I read all the religious scriptures I could find, and many of them were very interesting to me because I'd lived in the countries where they were practiced. But the one that made most sense to me was the Bible. Really made profound sense. It was intellectually complete and interesting, and it dealt with some of the paradoxes of life that weren't lineal, they weren't sequential. They were simultaneous paradox. And as I dug into Psalms, for example, some of the early Psalms, you meet someone who's convicted of sin, yet feels righteous, yet knows God's in charge, yet knows he can't, you know, it was exactly the dilemma that I'd experienced in real life.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, that's strike one. Most of the others are uncompelling, though they have some wisdom. But this one's really interesting. So that's what I'll say. If Anna asked me, which she did, at the age of two, I was climbing a hillside in Queensland while our exhausted mother was sleeping with the next child. And she said to me as I hauled her up on a rock and the sun was rising, Daddy, where was I before I was born? So I hadn't planned for that question, but I'd sort of been going in the right direction to try to prepare. Second thing that happened was I determined that Anna would be christened. And this is what Church of England people did, and we had a christening gown in the family passed down from those generals who'd retired in Bath all those years before. And so she was going to be christened, so I contacted the local Church of England church, which was St. Clement's Mossman, and it was run by John Mason. And I asked him to come to my house, which he did, and it was an evening time, and I said, I'd like you, John, to christen my daughter. I thought I said that in a respectful, sufficiently authoritative way that he would respond with yes. But I had not met John Mason before. And John said to me, well, you can do that or I'll do that for you certainly, but you'll need to attend a special course I have. I think it was Christianity Explored or Christianity Explained. And I must say I reacted to that in a very unhelpful way. I was tired, it was late, starting to start a business, and here was a chap who was supposed to christened my daughter, was putting conditions around it. So I thought, well, I know how to deal with this. So I dialed up confrontation and had no impact. Just, I don't know if you know John Mason, but steel blue eyes and a square chin would describe him. Didn't flinch. And I could feel Sally, dear Sally, tense and unhappy in the background. So I agreed to go. And I thought, well, what I'll do is disrupt those first classes. So he'll ask me to leave. And so over a couple of rounds of those classes, I asked foolish questions and tried to disrupt. And then it became clear to me that he wasn't being disrupted. He was calm. He was not particularly amused, but completely unruffled by what I thought was a pretty powerful intellectual assault on his belief system. But he seemed to have answers.
Yeah.
It was the first time in my adult life I'd confronted another adult that was prepared to do battle and do it well. So after a while, I shut up and started listening. And I learned a lot on that course. And again, it consolidated that sense that Christian scripture was profoundly interesting and different.
Mm.
But as you may know, Jenny, and I don't know your story, but it's a long way from there to committing your life to Christ.
Mm.
Mm. And so as it turned out for me, it took business disaster. It took the breaking of the things that were sacred idols to me in retrospect.
Mm.
It took bringing me to my knees, literally, to turn me to Christ.
Mm.
And what that was an altercation with the partners that had founded that great firm that I was so pleased to be part of and a founding member of, over a very sensible business issue where I felt the firm had to change that issue if it was ever to succeed and meet its full potential. And we couldn't agree. And it seemed like the honorable thing to do for that larrikin running in the hills and doing those things was to be cut and dried and for me to leave if that was the case. Having struggled to change the plan, I left. The net of that was that I was immediately sued by them for twice my net worth. I had young children, a mortgage, and I'd had a job. In fact, had been quite a wealthy person with real purpose in a secular sense until then. But now I was a man with negative net worth, considerable, $20 million of negative net worth. It's like having a bounty on your head.
Mm.
But it got worse. I couldn't work in any geography where I'd worked before. I broke non-competes. And it got worse. Some time later, cumulatively, 14 different families came to me from my old operation and said, "We don't know where you're going, but we're coming too." So now I'm minus $20 million of personal net worth. I have no job. I can't work in any place that I've worked in before. And there are 14 other families that think I've got some ability to assist. That was pretty bad. And in fact, it was poignantly bad the day that Sally went to a cash machine to get some money out for the grocery. And I was trying to hold together these guys' lives on payroll. And the payroll had been put through our personal bank account. And she had a credit balance on the bank account, which her friend next to her saw, of minus $350,000. And she called me alarmed, not surprisingly.
Mm. Mm.
So it was getting pretty intense.
Mm.
So that was breaking point for me. Everything that I treasured, mattered, that seemed manageable, was in ruins.
As we take a break, I want to tell you about the Graduate Diploma of Divinity at SMBC. Tim Sims, my guest today, completed his grad dip of Divinity over 4 years at our Northern Beaches Centre in Narrabeen. The grad dip can be done full-time or part-time. It's ideal for Bible study and youth group leaders, one-to-one ministry roles, or actually anyone who wants to dig deeper into God's Word. We have on-campus and off-campus modes of study, so there's really no better time to go deeper into the Word of God. With some great study options now available, on campus at Narrabeen or Croydon. For all the details, head to the study section on our website at smbc.edu.au. And taking you to that breaking point, was that, do you remember a moment when you just said something to God? Did you, at that point, did you cry out to God?
Well, I think deep down in that little boy, because we never grow up really, was a coping mechanism that was very surgical when things became tough. I've noticed it. So it became obvious and it became apparent that the only thing that I could do was to do something that was unthinkable for a rational person, which was to go into a room and talk to God. And if you think you hear emotion on the microphone, it is. Because it was a very, very challenging moment.
Yeah.
But I did go into a room and I spoke with God. And what happened next was especially helpful for me, which is as I came out of that room, the telephone rang with a solution to my dilemma. So so that was my first experience of really heartfelt prayer.
It's amazing. Tim, what was it about that telephone call that changed everything for you?
I was on sort of survival rations in Africa. It was a territory I could work in. It had to be English-speaking so that I could generate work for those who trusted me to come with me. So I was working there and I was commuting as I'd described. But I couldn't create enough surplus funds to fight a lawsuit in at least three different jurisdictions. If you really want to hurt somebody, you hit them in more than one jurisdiction with no resources. And so what that phone call was, in fact, was a dear friend from my first employment in the consultancy in Europe who had remembered me. He'd heard of my plight, and he telephoned me and he made me an unbelievable offer. He said, if you can fly to me and meet me at my global partner meeting, we will consider underwriting the fees necessary for you to fight your lawsuit. And if we succeed, we'd like you to come and run our operations in Asia Pacific. So right there was, you know, I was literally back to the wall with no breaking point, no possibility of breaking out on survival rations and flagging, you know, was taking stamina and pain. But right there was an extraordinary ticket out of my dilemma. And I could say again, you know, but one can't count on this, but God has shown up so often at critical moments. There was a moment much later on in history where we were challenged to move geographies and take a much larger responsibility in the system that we're working in. And I couldn't do it because of family and other commitments. But a man called Mitt Romney, again, had been a friend.
I think we've heard of Mitt.
Mitt had been a friend in the early 80s. We did recruiting together in Europe and the US and had many adventures. I went to see him and I said, I want to cross over from consulting into private equity because I think I've run my race in the consulting space. And Mitt said, I'll help you do that. And in the next hour and a half, he helped me raise a $150 million fund. And I said, well, how do we document this, Mitt? What do we do? And he said, you can have a copy of my document and perhaps put a map of Australia on the front. I'll help you. So those sorts of things are not normal and were extraordinary, and I give thanks to God for those things.
And so would you say that from that point on, how did things change for you in terms of life generally, family and purpose?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, physical and business life were very demanding. But I'd found a new sense of, and again, I mentioned the Psalms earlier, but and I'm reading them again now, so I'm reminded of it. But this tremendous sense that while everything was broken around me and I could only do what I could do, the end was dealt with. And it was going to be all right. And so I persevered and worked hard, and we were greatly blessed through that time of struggle. But then it became apparent, obviously, that we didn't know our Bible. And so we took a course, which I found enormously valuable, and again, would encourage ordinary pew-sitting Christians to make it their business, not just to go to Bible study, but to seriously study, if you can, seriously study the Bible from a theological perspective. I know I'm sitting in the premises of SMBC now, but I'll give you a free ad. I mean, again, as a much older person now, Sally and I have just finished a graduate diploma, which has been an enormous privilege, having really competent, capable, and you see I've been exposed to some of the world's elite education establishments, but the quality of teaching that comes out of this school and others in this in Sydney is extraordinary. And to be able to sit under that teaching and study the Bible is a pretty special thing. So I think most of my knowledge of God, other than experiential, has come from studying the Word and being helped to study the Word by colleagues.
It's interesting how you were taken to the very depths. Mm. And yet now, humanly speaking, or in terms of the world, you are very successful as a businessman in business. Mm. How has the Lord used what you're doing now in the workplace to further the gospel? What do you do? What priorities do you have?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say, Jenny, and thanks for that question, is that there's no tension between business success and loving God and working under God. Mm. Christians, I think, sometimes try to imagine that tension and imagine that somehow business is incompatible with that. Mm. And that's not true of our heritage. It's not true of what the Bible tells us. Mm-hmm. You go into those early chapters of Ecclesiastes, and one particularly favorite verse comes early on. Not six ventures, but seven, because you don't know which venture will succeed. Mm-hmm. You know, we're encouraged under God to be brave. Mm-hmm. As Christians, we can worry about our inputs. We're responsible for what we do, but we're unique people on the planet in that we are not responsible, in that we don't own the outcome. Mm-hmm. We own the income, but we don't own the outcome. Mm-hmm. And this should make us very thoughtful, very responsible, clearly sinful at the same time, but thoughtful and responsible and methodical, but not afraid of risk if it's been sensibly taken. And it turns out that in business, and the history proves this, that Christians can be successful in business because of their attitude to risk. Mm. Mm. Their egos are not on the line in the same way that perhaps others are, where the church is themselves or the church is their identity. I can't claim to be free of that. I'm not died to self to that extent. But I think we do have an advantage. And when applied in business, the other thing, of course, is that integrity, as much as I have it, which isn't as much as I would like, or true dealing and fair trading are enormously valuable business concepts. And so the result is that, yes, we have been blessed with a very successful combination of businesses, which in large part are driven by people that have chosen to associate with me, and I'm greatly blessed in that. But it's also led to a place where the cash and the wealth generated by that has been available for responsible kingdom work, and we're grateful for that.
That's wonderful. When you think about all the ways in which you went to a boarding school where you were exposed to the gospel, where you were taken to the heights and then to the depths, and the Lord, through people like John Mason and through the Lord himself, really picking you up. Where you are now, Tim, what keeps you where you are, so to speak? What holds you firm in the context of the day-to-day temptations and pressures of life? What holds you firm in the gospel?
I wish I could give a very simple one-line answer, but let me try a couple of different filters. I think the first thing is that it's been my experience, and perhaps yours, Jenny, and the experience of other Christians I speak to, that we become more and more convicted of our brokenness and our sinfulness as we learn to know more of Jesus. And it's an incremental journey of, you know, clearing up some of the obvious bad stuff and then discovering that some of the other stuff, which is not so obvious, is even badder. Mm. And you get to a place of great awareness of the sort of the enemies of pride and dissemblement, let's not say lying, but dissemblement and selective memory and all of the other things that come into our relationships. Mm. And we'll never be freed of that. Mm. But with the power of the Spirit and with sober self-assessment and with the benefit and blessing of friends and a wonderful wife to help with constructive criticism, I think we continue that journey as best we can. That's that Philippians 1 notion, right? The work will be taken forward in us. So that's one filter. I think another is a constant sense of the need to remind oneself of humility in the midst of what can be an intoxicating environment. That's relatively easy for that little insecure guy, right? Because he knows that he's lucky to be in the classroom with the boys standing up saying the Lord's Prayer. He's more than lucky to be walking around Oxford in a an academic gown. He's extraordinarily lucky, and so it goes on. Mm. So I've never felt anything other than a sort of fortunate not to have been found out and to be able to joke my way along. And that same humility, which I guess is embedded from that, makes it a bit easier. But also the example of great people that I won't name because they wouldn't want me to, but the example of great people that I've come across who've managed to preserve humility in the midst of greatness. One of them, again, should remain unnamed, but he came to my office one day, and this was a person I'd read about in books and was extraordinarily impressed by. And turned out the real person was exactly as the person in the book, which is most unusual. Mm. But at one point he said, "We should pray." And I was in my office, and there was a little coffee table in my office. He said, and so I sort of slumped forward as you do and put my hand on my forehead in an attitude of prayer. And he said, "No, Tim, this is really serious. We need to pray about this. We need to be on our knees before God." So there I was in my office on my knees, just, I'm sure, praying simultaneously that my assistant wouldn't come in and find me in such a position on the ground. But sure enough, she did. But those examples, the examples of that sort of courage, you know, no messing about, we're serious, let's get on our knees and pray. Doesn't matter where we are. So I think the encouragement of others, a deep sense of natural insecurities helped me, thank you God, and also a sense of coming to know and teach and learn and be around others who are learning, and a sense of profound sinfulness is my guide. You know, that keeps me honest, I guess.
Tim, I am so encouraged by your story and the story of God's grace in your life, and I really appreciate you coming and sharing that with us today. So thank you.
Thanks, Jenny. Thanks for your kindness and gentleness in asking me some pretty hard questions. And that steam on this screen between us is the steam of emotion and quiet tears. I'm glad that the cameras are not rolling.
Thanks, Tim. I hope you've enjoyed being part of the conversation with Tim today, and importantly, been encouraged to be salt and light to those around you. Coming up next episode, I'll be talking to a man who is a much sought-after mentor in Christian ministry and one who has seen churches through the most fractious conflicts. I'll see you then. Salt is hosted by me, Jenny Salt, and produced by Mark Hadley. Editing by Hadley Inc. For all show notes and more episodes, head to smbc.edu.au/salt. Salt is a Sydney Missionary and Bible College podcast and part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Thanks for making Salt possible.